We're excited to change the world of startups for the better, but trying to make a difference and turning our good intentions into reality has proven to be more complicated than expected. We constantly encounter unexpected second-order effects. When we solve one issue, we end up unintentionally creating another one. It's dawning on you that being a good leader is more complex than simply having that one big idea. True leadership is about the difficult decisions and trade-offs you encounter whilst executing it. On this show, we explore the entrepreneurial zeitgeist with the aim to work and lead differently. Between all of us, we can decode what it will take to be a leader today. In today's episode, Juliana Mendes and I decode some of the myths around startup growth and what it takes to be successful in B2B SaaS. Juliana is a fractional growth marketing leader for B2B SaaS startups. She leads growth marketing teams for a fixed time of 3 to 6 months, so she needs to make good things happen quickly. She gets hired to solve specific growth challenges to build, hire, and develop growth marketing teams and implement cross-functional processes and a culture of growth. And just to clarify, growth marketing is a cross-functional approach across marketing, product, and sales that is looking to optimize end-to-end, from acquisition to retention and monetization. Juliana has a very data-led, lean, and experimentation-based approach, and I really appreciate her learnings from knowing the behind the scenes of a variety of startups and teams. So let's dive in.
I'm a fractional head of growth or VP growth. So when I'm coming into a company, usually there's a team already there that I need to basically bring on a growth track. And with this job, I don't have a lot of time to actually make impact. So I need to first really check, okay, what is the team? What are the conditions we're having? And is the right growth mindset and the right growth culture, is it there? So a lot of the things that I need to really be working are things like clear responsibilities and KPI ownership. If they are not there, this is something we need to basically fix from the start. It's very important that everyone knows what's their role, that everyone knows what they're responsible for. And very often, surprisingly often, that's not the case. So I'm coming in and people are basically working on tasks they're given instead of actually owning the goal. And that is one of the first things that we're changing, or that I'm changing when I'm coming into a team to make it work. Yeah, it's also, I think, very important to make sure that context is there. So very often there's still a lot of silos in the companies between marketing team, product team, sales team, or also leadership and the teams. So that's one of the things where I noticed that if you have a lot of transparency, communicating with the team and between the different functions, this context can help people to take over responsibility, for example. I do also believe that it's very important that there's always one owner of a certain task. So we are working with quarterly goals, and from the start, we're going to set them up and we're planning them down to metrics that everyone owns and initiatives that everyone needs to get done in a certain quarter or in a certain month. And one thing that is surprisingly often not the case is that it's not working if you have multiple people owning something. There needs to be one person who has the hat on and is responsible for this goal and for this initiative. It's either way one or no one owns it.
That makes a lot of sense. And it also makes a lot of sense that that is what people struggle with. And I know I'm working with that a lot with my team, trying to set the expectation, trying to get the clarity. And it's an ongoing process. And I think it's also a cultural change in terms of how we are used to work, how we are used to define success, what kind of feedback we get. And so I would assume you're a big advocate and catalyst for culture change within the teams that you're working with. And I'm curious, what are maybe some activities that you do in the first month so people build trust in you and so that people feel courageous to embark on that journey with you?
One of the most important things is obviously listening to the team and getting to know them and understand what they want, how they understand their role. I am a big believer in what I mentioned before, that if you give people context and transparency in terms of this is what we want to achieve, this is what your role is here, and this is what we think we can do together as well, this gives a lot of trust and will help people to make them understand that this is their part of this game. But also, I think in a lot of companies, there's, and I'm struggling constantly with this when I'm coming into new teams, that there's very different levels of how much failure is accepted to communicate. So understanding that even though you're an owner, it doesn't mean that you have no backup from anyone else. This is, at the end of the day, a team effort and a team task. We're all working together. And it's very important to make that clear, that we need to be able to talk open about failures or things that maybe not go so well, and things that we want to improve, without making this an ego thing. So removing, or helping the team to remove ego from the work with me and all of us together, is a really big step for me to understand that we're working together on this.
How do you encourage people to admit failure? Is that something where you share your failures, or you tell them like, hey, this is okay? Like, how does that process start if that's not part of the culture yet?
I do usually really start with just looking at the data and also being able to say like, okay, here I see this. And there's something that could have led to this. And it's not a finger pointing. It's really about, you know, facts and fact-based communication. I do think that's something that needs to be learned. Like, you know, I want people to understand that when I say something, or when they say something, it should have a fact somehow as a foundation. And it shouldn't just be something that I'm saying because whatever, I'm the manager, I'm the boss, or just because the CEO says it, that's what needs to be done. So I feel trust can be built as well by focusing on this kind of transparency and making sure that they understand the big context and that they're understanding I can communicate this. The other side is, of course, I will go ahead and say the same thing, right? So if there's anything going wrong, it's part of me communicating as well. Okay, there was something that didn't go well. And then asking the questions as well to the team. It's like, why did this go wrong? What can we learn from this? What can we take from this? So one of the, let's say, routines around this are, and it's going closely together with learning data literacy as well. So making sure that, for example, we're having once a month a data review meeting where we're all looking into the KPIs, but also trying to pull not only like, this is what the numbers say and this is what they are, but also like, trying to interpret them and understand, okay, what has been working here, what has not, and what are the next action items. And with this approach, we're removing the person or someone being responsible from the whole item. And it's really like the fact-based communication. So this is my way of building this, because I strongly believe that this is the way that goes the fastest. Especially as a fractional leader, I am not often there to be with them face to face. So I'm not traveling there. It's like mainly remote. So FaceTime alone cannot be the fact to build trust. So these are the things that I do to do this instead.
I love that a lot. And I would love to learn more about the data review meeting. Who is there? Is that the entire team or just the leaders? And then what type of data is being presented? Because we talked about context, and also before we hit record, we talked about transparency. And so I'm curious what type of metrics, which level of detail, who's at that meeting, and then what's the usual flow of that call?
It's different in different teams, but usually all the people who are owning a key result or a key KPI in the team, they are there. So we have a template actually in every single one of these calls, where we have one column is, you know, the category or the KPI, and then we have the owner. And then we have one where it says, okay, this is our numbers. This is what happened, the insights, like, was it going better? What did we learn from this? And then the third one is an action item. So like that, I'm teaching them as well in a way that we are not looking at numbers just because, but every data point that we're communicating needs to have an action item. And if it doesn't, or it doesn't make sense to have an action item, it shouldn't show up there. So like that, we're also filling our next sprint, and we're understanding like, were our experiments successful or not? Because the big problem with a lot of things is that we do run experiments, we do run tests, and then partly they are forgotten, or the learnings are not used to be applied in other areas, because a lot of things that we can learn from one experiment, what kind of language, what kind of messaging works, for example, can be applied in other ways and needs to have a follow-up action. So this is my way of making sure that this is not getting lost.
That is great. This makes me want to implement this in my company as well. I'm curious, how do these meetings go? Are these pretty lively discussions, or is it more a lot of awkward silence? And if it is a lot of awkward silence, how do you encourage people to participate?
Again, here, I think it's really about ownership. So everyone needs to participate because they are the owner of a metric or of something. And it's usually quiet, maybe on the first or two times, because this is where I learn as well. Like, okay, where does the team stand? Or if I give them this task, are they able to do the right things? Or do we still need to teach about data literacy? Do they know where to get the numbers from? Very often, or surprisingly often, people have not been looking at the numbers maybe for the last 3 or 4 months and maybe looked at the impact certain things had in detail. For example, what kind of, visuals have been winning? What kind of content has been the most engaging? What things have been working the best and converted in the long run the best in sales as well? So these things we need to look at. And if it's not working the way we want, that shows me, okay, we need to teach them a bit more. We need to give them the right tools. Then I'm trying to share as well, how do you differentiate insights versus just data reporting? So I tend to do data literacy workshops where people are learning about, okay, there's a difference between good and bad metrics and how to not hide between vanity metrics. This meeting is not about just looking at vanity metrics, but really about something where we can learn from. Again, action items. Is that really the thing that matters for us? So I'm trying to implement these things and do these workshops for teams where they're not at that level, because I do think that everyone needs to be a bit of an analyst if they're owning a KPI. I think that's very crucial for success in their role.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Explain to me your process for choosing the right metrics. Because, for example, as an SEO consultant, it's very easy to choose a metric like traffic. And then all of my clients basically have two blog posts that rank for whatever reason, not because they were specifically aiming for that, not because it's the most important topic. It's just because Google randomly chose to rank it and they get a lot of traffic for it, but they never convert for it. So now we tick the traffic goal, but we're not ticking the conversion and business impact goal. And almost every time I check a client's site, they have a handful of these articles that just rank for whatever reason, but don't do anything. And so I'm curious, it seems if we're so hyper-focused on these metrics, if we're looking at them on a monthly basis, it seems to be very important to choosing the right ones. And so what's your methodology around that? And then how often do you switch it out?
I like to work with a framework. One is the North Star metric, what is really the thing that we want to have at the end of the day? And then the other one is the one metric that matters now. So usually I'm looking at the funnel or the steps that need to be taken from the first contact or any kind of touch point to what we actually want to achieve. And I'm looking at where do we have the biggest opportunities? What is the biggest problem right now? Where is this process the most broken at this point? And this is where the one metric that matters right now will be defined. So this is what we're looking at. If we're in the data review meeting, there's people from different teams. So for example, if I say there's the website owner who's maybe owning certain things like lead gen on the website, then this person needs to look at themselves from this aspect. What is the one metric that matters right now on the website? What is the most broken on the website where we have the most potential for growth, for example, to convert more leads? Let's say there's one landing page where we have a lot of traffic, but it doesn't convert for some reason. What can be done there? Or our homepage or similar things like that. Just an example. That's a bit the focus that I'm trying to give. But yeah, very often this is a bit like a squeeze toy talking about second order effects. If you fix one metric on one side, then it blows up on the other side and then suddenly you cost possibly another problem with that needs fixing. So that's why it's always good to have the North Star metric on the other end to help you understand where do you actually want to go at the end of this? What's the outcome you want to have? And then you can play with this and fix one problem after the next so that we're not trying to fix everything at once.
One thing you mentioned is that most companies that we know, and I see that too, is love the idea of ownership, extreme ownership. It's in our mission statements, our values. We put it into all of our job description. Firstly, tell me, what does ownership mean? And then how did leadership contribute to team members not owning certain things in the way they could be?
I think it's really two sides, right? So one is ownership from my side. So I take a lot of ownership in making the team or making it clear for the team, what's our mission? Where do we want to go? And make sure that there's no ambiguity for the team to understand what they need to do and what we want to achieve. That everyone has the right information to take decisions and understands their specific role. So I think that leaders need to own this part a lot, and also the planning, and make sure that resources are planned properly. And if there's a misunderstanding in any way, I do think that I'm responsible as a leader to make sure there's none. So it's not like just finger pointing at the team didn't understand it right. It's really about like, okay, what could I have done to improve this? Because very often, you know, it's something that I could have fixed as a leader. On the other side, it's also from the team, of course, ownership for their specific areas of what they're working on. And this means that I would like them to commit to the things as well. So if they are having a certain responsibility and I'm delegating that responsibility to the team, they need to own that responsibility as well. And I need to hold people accountable for that as well, because I think one of the things that are definitely going in the wrong direction is if you don't hold people accountable because you're fearing that it could maybe have negative impact on the team motivation or mood or something. Because if you don't hold someone accountable for not doing the things that they're supposed to do, that's becoming the new standard. And that's something that you don't want to happen. You need to make sure that everyone in the team keeps the standard high. And that, again, is my responsibility as a leader as well, to make sure that happens.
How does the holding accountable work? Is that part of your one-on-ones or team meeting? What type of process do you have in place for that?
I think there's different things. So one of them is we need to really make sure that we stick to timelines, and that timelines, deadlines are something that we find important and that, you know, are not just moved every day, whatever comes up, and that it's something that people take really serious. So we do work with sprints, and we do work, for example, very often with biweekly sprints, where at the end, you know, it's like a nice feeling to also see like what was accomplished and what was not accomplished. And it's okay if something doesn't get done, but then we need to have the feedback as well. Why did it not work? What should we do better the next time? Or was there something that was in our hands to improve that or to make it fit? So this commitment to deadlines is one that is definitely very important. But also, of course, in one-on-ones. So if there's certain things that haven't been done, and I'm then asking as well, like, what was the reason? And that's something I need, of course, in a one-on-one to understand. And I need openness from the other side for that, to understand what can I do to help you? Because maybe it's that you are not feeling very comfortable in this new area that you're owning, or this task, or you don't exactly know how it works. And then I can help. I can help to provide resources. I can help provide frameworks. I can give feedback. And this is something that we need to discuss in a one-on-one. But if nothing works and, you know, a person is not doing it or not fitting in the team, in the rest of the team, in terms of their commitment and accountability, of course, it's also my responsibility to change that. So I do think that it's very important to coach the team and to make sure that we try our best to bring this person up to speed. But if it's not possible, and it means that the entire mission is, let's say, at risk, at big risk, then I need to also possibly then make changes and find someone who's better for that role. And I do think that is a very, very important responsibility of the leader to make sure that the final mission and goal is achieved as well.
Absolutely. I have a practical question, and maybe that is also my own curiosity, is like, how and where do you track all this? And who is in charge of tracking this? And what I mean by that is, do you keep like very detailed meeting notes? Do you put that all into the project management tool? Who owns, you know, keeping that updated? Is that you or is that the team member? And how do you set up that process?
On a task level base, we do have sprint boards. So it really breaks down. Like we have, you know, for example, we're working with OKRs, with quarterly goals. So we have a board where we can write down what is our objectives, what is our key results that we want to accomplish, and we're having owners for these key results. But also every key result is broken down into initiatives we want to do. So we're planning them quite meticulously at the end of and beginning of the new quarter, because I do believe exactly that will help us track process very well. And these initiatives are broken down into tasks that we are tracking in our sprint board, which we check every 2 weeks. So we're having a sprint planning meeting where we go and pull the things that we need to do next into our sprint. And at the end of the sprint, after 2 weeks, we're checking what has been done and what not, like we discussed before. And then the rest, of course, is also, so everyone, like I said, has always his board as well, his responsibilities where they can check what's the things that I'm accomplishing. So it's very easy to go through on an individual level. But then we have one-on-ones where we discuss more things, higher level of what do you need. And we do have quarterly, it's really different in companies, but I do think it's a really good practice to have quarterly meetings with the person to also discuss progress in a bigger picture. So then, for example, we are writing down development areas of this person. And I like to work with scores. So for example, let's say I want you to understand more details about, I don't know, product development or how to build a new business model, for example. Or I want you to learn more about conversion rate optimization. And maybe your knowledge is now a 2. I want you to get to a 5. And this is what you need to do to show that you get there. And also, these are the resources that you could use. And this is a way of tracking for me progress that we can discuss then together, like, okay, after 3 months or after a certain amount of time, like, what have you done in this time? Have you achieved that? And give me some examples of where you applied that. And then we can discuss them. So yeah, that's for everyone a very transparent process, which I do think I don't need to do with everyone all the time, but specifically for people that need to develop more or want to develop more, this is very helpful and very detailed as well.
Great. Great. I'm learning a lot. I'm like, all right, taking mental notes of how I want to structure some calls and conversations. One concept that we also touched upon previously that goes with all of this is this idea of like decentralized command. And I think often the tendency is maybe for the founders or the managers to make decisions. This can produce a lot of delays and roadblocks, and we want people to be more independent, have more ownership, take their own decisions. And so how can we as leaders embrace that? And what do we need to do to enable our team to do this?
First of all, I do think that there's really a limited amount of people that a person can have as a direct report in order to do the job right. Like the things we discussed, one-on-ones and, you know, regular meetings to make sure that there's actual value and this person can progress. You cannot do 20 direct reports. And I have to say, that is for me also always a bit of a red flag if I hear that someone has been doing that all the time or that is what is required, because I would not join a company where it's like that, because I know I wouldn't be able to do the job right. So I would need to have another person in the team who can maybe be some sort of coordinator. And the way how I see that is that, you know, you can break topics down into groups of, I don't know, a couple of people. And then you have a person that then gets the role of ownership or the ownership for a certain task. So that's me delegating. And I need to now provide this person with the right information as well. So a very important point here is to make sure that they have access to the same information that I have, which is surprisingly often still a problem, because not always in the companies they want to share data around revenue or sales with everyone in the company, which I do find not always very helpful. So if you want people to take their own decisions and to have the right context, they need to know these kind of things as well and need to have access to the information. It cannot be filtered all the way. So this is one of the steps that need to be taken to decentralize command. Also, although maybe in some companies, the founders or the CEO says like, you should really take the decisions for all these things. Although I will take the final decisions and the team needs to understand what's their area of where they can take decisions. So I don't need to, for example, for every little detail, maybe look over how everything is written. So there needs to be clear rules around what they can do and at which point do they need to get feedback from me. And we do this by, of course, like communicating what are these rules, like, for example, until which budget can you decide? Or we decide, for example, in our sprint boards or in initiative boards, we do have, for example, a field where I can say, okay, for these ones, I will be the person to do the final approval or the final feedback. And then I know, you know, the other ones you can do yourself. They are not maybe as big where I would like to have a final say in this. That's how I'm doing that. And I strongly believe that this also creates trust in the team, circling back to what we discussed before. If they see that they're given responsibility and that they're given trust to do the things and like a bit of a area to move independently, this helps them to be more motivated and to be more trusting. And I think it improves overall the culture.
I agree with that. I'm curious on the whole topic of numbers sharing, revenue sharing, sales data, deal sizes, these sort of things. Have you ever worked with a company that maybe was more secretive before and then decided to open up, maybe also decided to open up because they're working with you? And then how was that received? And what did you need to train the team on in order to comprehend what they're looking at?
I have worked with all kinds of companies, really secretive companies where nothing can be shared with anyone, not even like budgets or something, you know, marketing budgets. Or I've worked with companies where everything, including salaries, were open and transparent for everyone to see. I do believe that the transparency at the end of the day, although I don't think that necessary salary transparency is a must have, but like, transparency on all the data, like sales data, what are we selling, where do we go, makes it much, much easier for everyone in a company to rally behind that goal that we're trying to reach. Because otherwise, like this whole context is missing and it's really hard for you to communicate. You need to get more sales, but I'm not going to tell you how much. So it's really hard. Like, how should that work? And maybe there's some fears around, oh, people are thinking that this is, you know, too high, or then they don't understand what kind of costs are involved, or then they want more commissions and sales, or da 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 da. There's a bit of a pathway. You need to communicate it. Be transparent with your team and make sure that you explain, like, look, right now, this is our costs and overall in the company, and this is what's left. For example, or this is our, you know, margin that we keep from that, just so people are a bit informed about these things and how they all play together. And I think there's, of course, levels where you maybe cannot always take the time for every single thing to explain in detail, like how the cost structure is. But it's also, I feel, proving a bit your system, because if you are able to communicate openly about it, you see that if it makes sense, and that people are participating on it as well. And I think that's very important. And I would always vouch for the more transparency part. And companies have been allowing it more or less to do more. And I'm always advocating for this when I'm working with a company.
I would say I'm like quite revenue driven in the sense that, of course, you know, it's nice, you know, you make more revenue, there's more profits, et cetera, more money to spend. But I think the bigger part where I'm interested in revenue growth or why it motivates me, it's more as this gamification. This is like, all right, that's what we did last year. What does it take to go up even more? Like the creativity behind achieving the goal, I would say is what motivates me more than the pure number. But Do you find that team members that they are maybe not managers are motivated by a revenue goal? And then especially, does that come with a share? Like if a revenue goal is met, do people get like a profit share or more holidays or more benefits? Or basically I'm asking like, how do we rally someone with a fixed salary, you know, behind a revenue growth goal? Like how to wrap that into a compelling offer?
I have all kinds of situations. Like, for example, sometimes I'm working with a sales team that has no commissions whatsoever. They're just all getting a fixed salary. And the way how we're working with them is, well, first of all, they are people that are actually like really behind the goal. You know, there's a mission. So this mission is communicated very strongly and they believe in it. So they believe that with every sale, they're improving the world a little bit. So that is actually like a really important part of how this culture functions. And I think that's great to see, but it's not always happening like this. And in this case, you know, it doesn't make so much sense maybe to communicate the revenue, but it's then communication about like how many women in this case did you impact, for example, or, you know, how many sales did you do, the actual number. And of course, we're going to look at weekly, monthly, quarterly results to make sure that, you know, we all have something that we can contribute to that. And also make sure that it's, again, you know, that everyone has their goals. So it's not just a team thing. Like everyone knows what they need to reach in order to reach the actual sales numbers or what they can do. So I think it is a bit like what you said, the gamification, especially in sales. And also we're celebrating this, right? So when there's something happening that was great, and we celebrate that, we communicate that, we have certain milestones that we're reaching. And if we reach them, there's like something that we're saying. So I think this motivation part is really, really crucial in a team. And then if you have, you know, revenues or you have a sales team that has, for example, commissions based on sales, or also, you know, of course, the marketing team participating or contributing to this, I do think that it makes sense to look at the revenue and make sure that they also understand, okay, so for example, what is the revenue per customer that you're bringing? Because for them, if the revenue they're making or the contract value they're getting with a customer is getting higher, then they should get more as well. So like that, we can incentivize them to focus, for example, on the segment that we want. So it's really about like, what are they incentivized or and what matters, and that's what we count.
I love that.
Actually, I think the other way around, yeah.
I think we also just found a good example of second order effects. If you communicate, let's say, a revenue goal, and then that can be taken, you know, revenue no matter what, but it's like revenue, you know, with a certain type of customer, with a certain deal size in a certain industry, right? And that's what's making it a meaningful metric, not purely revenue, no matter what.
Yeah, no, because I think, I mean, at the end, this revenue outcome final thing, end of the year, total number is something that's really far removed from their day-to-day business, right? So it needs to be something they can, or the team can impact relatively fast and how they can see how it contributes to their overall goal. So just putting a revenue goal in there is like, doesn't say a lot, right? Like, okay, what does that mean now? How many more clients, like for example, a logo is for that reason really much more tangible than just like having the pure revenue number, because this is how many new clients we got. Great. This is what we count. Or how many people were applying or attending this webinar. It's not about, not so much about, you know, the pure dollars number only.
Agreed. How does a typical workday look like for you? And what I mean by that is, I think you seem to value a lot of communication, clarity, and context. And so I'd be curious, in your day, how much of your time do you spend in calls, in conversation with people versus maybe alone time, deep work type? And how did that come about?
That's a really good question. So I personally see myself in this leader function as well in a lot of communication with the team. So I do think that one way of this building this trust with the team is as well being available for them if there's questions, feedback, and so on. So I do have a lot of space for that, and I'm trying to be quite fast with my feedback that is required. So if they want to, you know, walk something through or have feedback on something, I'm available for that. This is my normal day very often that I, you know, have like another feedback call about something, or we're deciding on, or, you know, like a decision meeting for something. And I do have, especially at the beginning and end of the quarter, quite a lot of focus time where I'm really going into the data. I'm like looking what happened last quarter, what can we do next quarter, what needs to be added, where it's really about, you know, numbers and strategy. But I'm adapting throughout the quarter. But throughout the quarter, my job is really to unblock everyone in the team as much as I can. And then the rest is strategy every quarter, let's say. There's quite a lot of communication involved, but I'm also having for everyone, I mean, not so much for myself, but for everyone in a team, we have implement, or I always do implement no meeting days, so that we are having focused work, because although I am in meetings, my team shouldn't be, or the people I'm working with shouldn't be. So they should have way more time to actually get the work done instead of just like sitting with, you know, everyone talking about stuff. And then there's, of course, rules and routines about meetings. Like, for example, you need to have a clear outcome. There needs to be a clear goal, and there needs to be a level of like, okay, give me something to read before, so I know and have short time where I can say like, okay, this is what we can do, this is what we won't do, and we can get to the result faster, so that meetings don't need to last so long. Because for some reason, there's still a lot of companies where the default is to put like 45 minutes or an hour of meeting as a standard in the calendar. And that is way too much. I think no meeting should ever, like in exception cases, but should be longer than 30 minutes. And I do even think that a lot of them should be more like 20 minutes. Just, you know, you can do 20 minute blocks or even 25 minute blocks, because these 5 minutes will just help you to, these 5 minutes are already enough to do like the couple of notes that you need to do and like close this topic. And these 5 minutes can help. So yeah, I'm trying to encourage people to definitely schedule shorter meetings.
Quick question on that is, would your one-on-ones also be half an hour, or would that be a one-hour call?
So our one-on-ones are bi-weekly half an hour, but the quarterly calls are 1 hour. So there we have more space and we have to discuss a lot of things. But if anyone says like, hey, I think I need more time for a certain topic, like I'm very open to extend this. And we have meeting notes. For example, we work with Notion. Everyone has their one-on-one Notion page. And if we try to add the topics that we want to discuss roughly beforehand, so we see already if it's like a lot or not. And if it's required, we can extend.
That makes a lot of sense. As we're moving towards the end of our conversation, I kind of want to circle back to where we started, which is that you usually come into companies and they have really high expectations in terms of growth. You're new, you're changing a lot of things. What are some of the things that you do to bring and show impact early?
My strategy is, in the first moment, I really look at the data. I look at, I speak to the people. I get to know the product, of course, but only the data will give me quite fast an overview on where I think there's like a big drop off or a big, you know, the bigger opportunity possibly, and then focus there. And I think the way how I'm working with companies usually is that we need to focus on some longer term, midterm growth goals, but we also need to focus on something that is quick wins. So during this analysis that I'm doing at the beginning, there's always a list of quick wins and a list of things that are midterm, long-term growth goals that we should focus on. And certain channels are faster than others, like paid marketing or certain, you know, small things that can be adapted on a website, maybe if there's no form or like, I don't know, something like that, that can be done fast. And that's something we prioritize first so that we have some impact. And I'm implementing quite fast this process of sprint planning and reviews and so on, so that people are used to working at another speed and we have transparency from the start about what gets done and whatnot. And that helps everyone, although it's quite a change at the beginning for some, to start rolling fast. And management likes it as well, because they can see what's happening, which maybe was before not possible.
It creates a lot of transparency, creates a lot of trust and clarity for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Final question. If people want to get to know you better, where can they maybe check you out? Is that LinkedIn? Do you have a website, a talk that you want to recommend them?
I think the best is LinkedIn, Juliana Mendes. And I'm starting to share some things there. But yeah, other than that, I think, yeah, it's the best channel, LinkedIn.
Thank you so much for taking the time today. I don't even know if this was a podcast interview or personal coaching for me. I really, really appreciate it. I really love working with you and excited for the things that we can do together. And I really appreciate having you on today.
Thanks so much, Viola. That was fun. Bye.
Bye.